You're listening to podcasts from the Congressional Internet Caucus Advisory Committee, www.netcaucus.org.
How has technology and the Internet changed the way we connect, contribute, and communicate? Moderator was former Congressman Rick White, now of the Woodbay Group and co-founder of the Congressional Internet Caucus. Panelists were Bradley Horowitz of Yahoo and Marilyn O'Connell of Verizon.
Well, let's go ahead and get started. I think this microphone's working, and we're really delighted to have everybody joining our panel today. This is actually going to be a great discussion, at least as I see it, of what the Internet has helped us do so far and what it's going to help us do in the future. So we've got a couple of great people here to talk to us about it, and hopefully we'll have an opportunity for me to ask a few questions, but also for us to have a little interactive discussion with everybody in the audience. So please, we'll get started, and then really, I would say 10 or 15 minutes into it, we're happy to have some interruptions and comments and observations from the audience if you guys want to do that. Let me introduce these distinguished guests briefly, and then we'll get right into our program. On my left here is Bradley Horowitz, who's the Vice President for Product Strategy at Yahoo. And sitting next to Bradley is Marilyn O'Connell, who is the head of video solutions for Verizon. So we have really two, I think, very complementary sides of the industry represented here, and people with some really good perspective on what's happened so far and what's coming down the pike in the future. Well, let me just start off with a general question. As we were talking about earlier at lunch, I remember the days when we were talking about the Internet Caucus at its very early stage. There was lots of excitement about all the new things that technology was going to allow us to do. My own sense, as someone who's not really an expert but more of a consumer in the field, is that a lot of those promises have been realized, but some of the promises have not. So I'd be interested in each of your perspectives on what's gone well in the last 10 or 15 years in developing the Internet, and what has changed for the better, what hasn't gone well, and then we can talk maybe a little bit about the future. So, Brad, you want to start?
Sure. It's a great question and a really interesting one. Yahoo's been in the game since those early days. And I think what's interesting for me is a lot of the new buzzwords that you hear out there, user-generated content and Web 2.0 and this whole phenomenon about empowering people, really, if you read back to the original vision of not only Yahoo but the early pioneers in the Internet back in the mid-90s, it was all that stuff. This is kind of back to the future for Yahoo. So in terms of platforms of participation, we've always had things like Yahoo GeoCities, Yahoo Groups, platforms that allow people to contribute content and put people to the fore. I think what happened between then and now, there was a little thing called the bubble where the financial markets certainly got ahead of themselves, and it took some time. I think it's not just the bubble, but there's broadband penetration and people laying fiber and people getting high-quality, always-on access to the Internet. And I think also a cultural shift in people's relationship to the Internet and their comfort level in terms of sharing parts of their life on the Internet or communication on the Internet. You know, 5 years ago, Internet dating was a taboo kind of stigma. If you met your wife on the Internet, you were a little bit weird, and that's not the case at all today. So I think it's a combination of the world really catching up with that vision. But what's exciting is that the vision has pretty much remained true. And as you said, we've kind of caught up to that vision in lots of other dimensions. And I think it's especially exciting for Yahoo because in a lot of ways, this is where the fun part starts.
Mm-hmm. Marilyn?
Thank you. Yeah, it is a great question. I think that we're just maybe at the beginning of a revolution or evolution of the Internet. I don't think we've even seen the power of all that's out there. I think to Bradley's point, though, I think that some of the things that we talked about early happening are, it's interesting because we talk about a fad or a new idea coming about, and it's going to be a mass market idea next year, and that doesn't really happen that way. It actually takes a while for adoption to occur, but there's been some things that have happened a lot faster than other phenomena. For example, broadband adoption has outpaced almost all technology adoption in recent years, with the exception of probably the DVD. And then, of course, that's been an enabler for the Internet to actually grow more. When consumers go from being a narrowband customer to being a broadband customer, they use, engage in the internet more. It's a more satisfying experience. They start doing things like sharing photos and downloading video and becoming part of social communities and things of that nature. So I think that what will be interesting is 10 years from now, we could not have predicted the applications that are being used today, and we'll sit here 10 years from today, we'll not be able to predict what they're doing with it as well. So I think what's interesting is what the market has chosen to do with the internet and how it's also began to enter all parts of our lives and bleed out. So what you might have started to do on the internet, for example, the text messaging that was part of email is now part of the cell phone community. The video that was long tail content is going to be a part of the TV experience as well as part of the cell phone experience. So it's really more of, it might have started in the PC, it might have started in the internet, but I think it's a proliferation of media, entertainment, communication that we've yet to see it really sort of do what it will eventually do.
Well, I think that's all of our hopes, especially all of us who invested several times throughout the bubble and afterwards in what's going to happen. Let's talk just for a minute, though, about how the public did respond. You made a good point about broadband adoption, and we had a panel on that earlier where we talked a little bit about, how the public responds to when these new technologies are available. Do you guys feel that as soon as the technology is out there and it's kind of understood, people respond to it pretty quickly, or is there a learning process, not necessarily just from the consumer, but from the company's side, on how to make it available to people in a way that they can use it? In other words, have we learned something in terms of how to roll out some of these things and make them available to the public over the last 10 years?
Well, I will say our experience has been, of course, we went through the whole self-install experience with DSL, mm-hmm. and we learned a whole lot about that, and so did our customers. And, of course, when we went to roll out fiber, we actually almost went back to the early days of what service was all about, which you actually go into a consumer's house and you actually help them connect and make sure that everything's running before you leave. And I think what we're finding is that consumers, except for that bleeding-edge group, who will spend the weekend setting up a media bridge so that their PC talks to their TV set, they're not inclined exactly to embrace this as easily as we'd like them to do. And you actually have to give them a lot of tools. So whether it's the Geek Squad or whether it is educational tools or whether it's services that you're providing, because customers are finding the power of this very appealing. But I think that they're finding that embracing it and being able to make it a part of their lifestyle is still a challenge. And I think what we've learned is that we've got to help customers get there, that there's a lot more desire than sometimes there is will to sort of work through the complexity of technology. Mm-hmm. And it's really the onus is on us and companies like Yahoo and I think Verizon and others to help the consumers in that adoption curve. So it's not just the bleeding edge early adopters that enjoy this, but in fact a broader swath of the market.
That's a good point. And Brad, I know you guys obviously have international relations or customers and products and stuff all over the world. How do you see things in the United States comparing to what you see in other countries? Do we have a different uptake by consumers in other countries than we do here? How does it compare?
It's a really fascinating perspective. We reach 500 million people in the world with Yahoo over the course of a month, and that includes, that's roughly half the people that are online. And you're getting to a pretty good fraction of the world population there. You're dealing in really sizable numbers. So there's a huge variance in kind of the technical aptitude of our audience. And Yahoo, of course, prides itself on being customer-centric and providing an experience that makes sense for the soccer dad right up until the techie executive. So in terms of the international reach that we have, what's fascinating from where we sit is that there are a lot of things that are the same. People are the same, and sometimes the need to express themselves and communicate are the same. But there's fascinating differences as well in people's willingness to share their life online, in people's use of the technologies. There's just all kinds of cultural vignettes I'd love to share with you all. Experiences of the way that people use Instant Messenger in Vietnam. For some reason, Yahoo Instant Messenger has just dominated and taken over the market share in Vietnam. And a lot of it is communication with expatriates. A lot of it is video conferencing to kind of, hold up the baby and share lives that way. Other examples are places like Korea, where it's one of the most wired populations in the world. Virtually every literate adult has true broadband to the doorstep. But there's a different problem there. Korean is not a widely spoken language outside of Korea, small island nation. So the corpus of web documents that they had was relatively small compared to English. And so search in Korea was not very effective. They would search for a document in Korean, and there was nothing there. And that challenge prompted us to create a product which we call Yahoo Answers, which is kind of an inversion of the search problem. Instead of searching for something that's out there on the web, it allows you to ask a question of an ordinary person, and the community responds with an answer. It's a different way to search, connecting people to people as opposed to people to web pages. And it took off tremendously in Korea. And when we brought it globally, we weren't sure if it would work outside of that context of the small island nation with a small corpus of web documents, and it has grown dramatically. We launched it in the States about a year ago, and then in 12 different countries to date. There are now 60 million global users for this product, and it just was a great kind of proving ground. We learn a lot by these experiences in these little petri dishes. But again, you have to be very careful about extrapolating some of these lessons and finding out, is it specific to that culture and that community? Are they a half a generation ahead of us? Will it work in a different context? And it's a fascinating perspective that we have.
It's interesting. I was head of TechNet for a few years, and in that capacity, I had the privilege, or maybe it was the burden, of hanging out with the CEOs of a lot of these companies, and found out that they deal with a lot of problems that we all have to deal with. But I had the opportunity to sit down with the CEOs of each of your companies, and I wanted to ask each of you a question that I had just based on some of those conversations. Marilyn, I remember having dinner with your CEO several years ago, just at the time I think you guys had made the commitment to really build out a fiber optic mm-hmm. network and get it as close to the home as you possibly can. And, you know, there was a lot of discussion at that time about how, you know, this was really economically not feasible and was going to be very hard to do, and yet you guys accepted the challenge and really made it a cornerstone of you know, the development of your company. How's that going? How's it seen now at the company? The stock market sometimes reflects positively on it and sometimes doesn't. So I'd be interested in your sense of how that project is going now.
Well, from our perspective, it's going very well. We just released our fourth quarter numbers on Monday, and so we now have almost 700,000 customers that have our Fios internet service, and we have over 200,000 customers that have our video service, and that video service has really only been up most communities it's been up for less than a year, but we've been in the business for a little bit over a year. And if you go to Consumer Reports or you go to a lot of the blogs that are out there, I think you're going to find that customers that have Fios are really enjoying the service, that it provides them superior, you know, it's not, it still may be classified as a best effort service as because it's, you know, part of the network getting you to the internet, but quite frankly, it's more reliable. The speeds are, most of our customers take our 5 or 15 meg speeds, but we offer them all the way up to 50 meg in some markets on a downstream basis, and our upstream speeds are also superior at 2 to 5 meg upstream. Mm-hmm. So that really allows customers, so whether you're a gamer and you want that low latency so you can be, you know, winning in more multiplayer environments, or whether you're downloading large files as a telecommuter might, or you want our video product, I think people, there was room in the marketplace, even on the TV side, for a higher quality product. Mm-hmm. And I think that just goes to say that we made that decision. I've made that decision. Larry Babbio, who is our vice chairman of our telecom group, made that decision because they knew that we couldn't sit here today and predict. One thing that the industry, so no matter whether you're coming from the cable industry or you're coming from the online industry, we've all underestimated how much bandwidth the market really has an appetite for. But what we have continually seen is you put it out there, people will use it, they'll develop applications. And so if you're going to make an investment today in a network, and networks are a big thing, right? It takes a lot to put a network together. That's something that, you know, coming like Verizon's, that's what we do. But you put that out there, it takes many years for you to see a return on it because you're always investing in that. And so we need patience in the marketplace, which is not a common commodity in the investment community. But I think what I've been out talking to our investors most recently since we started releasing results, and also not only the the market reaction to it, but also how we're doing in terms of getting our cost targets down, the cost to pass a home, the cost to connect a home. Mm-hmm. And they're seeing us hit those targets. And so that's, I think, given them a sense, okay, from an execution basis, it's not only just a good idea, but you can execute it, and you can actually, customers want it, you can do it. And I think the pieces are coming together for the marketplace. So we're getting much more encouraging write-ups from the investment community as of late. I think the questions are less about, is this really a good idea, but more about, you know, let's just make sure you keep to your cost reduction targets and your market share penetration targets.
But your sense is there's definitely the market for that high-quality bandwidth, mm-hmm. or high bandwidth, and so you think it's probably been a good decision to be a leader in getting out there and having that available to your customers.
Absolutely.
Well, that's great. That's good to know, because the more bandwidth we can get, the better, I think. Bradley, I think I was hired at TechNet maybe a month or two before Terry Semel came on as the new CEO of Yahoo. Terry came from the entertainment industry, and at the time I thought that that might be a really good thing, because there were some disagreements or some things to work out between the technology community and the entertainment industry, and I thought he was the perfect guy to help bridge that gap. In some ways, I think it's probably fair to say those issues probably aren't quite as much at the forefront now as they were a while ago, and this may be an unfair question, but do you think that, how has that process worked? Has your company found a pretty good way to get along with the entertainment community and get the content that you need, or are there still things that we need to work on there?
I think it's a good question. I think what Terry's done for us is helped us understand that we are a media company, that's propelled by technology. And so if you look at Yahoo kind of in three phases, the first phase was just getting a footprint out there. You know, a lot of that was technical, driving awareness, getting people familiar with what the web was. The second phase of Yahoo's growth was really product-centric. It was about putting products to market that resonated with people, that brought people to Yahoo, that established this relationship of trust. And the next phase, the current phase, is really focused on audience. And much as a media business would segment its audience and think about the demographics and think about focusing its efforts in terms of how can they serve that audience and engage that audience and bring that audience back and provide value, I think that's the shift that Terry has kind of presided over, from kind of a technology-centric business that was just kind of getting us up to the plate where we could begin to think about our business in that holistic way. And so another way of saying it is we are in the attention game, and as such you can think of us as a media company. We aggregate people's attention, and then we broker that attention to advertisers who vie for that attention and are willing to pay for that attention. And as such, I think we become a media company. It's not simply our relationship to the media companies. I think we become a media company. In terms of efforts that have been discussed in the press about Yahoo creating a lot of original content, I think we've always been a very pragmatic company, and we will create content, and we do. We will license content from partners, and we have great relationships with studios, record labels. There's a lot of innovation there. And then finally, this whole phenomenon of user-generated content. Mm-hmm. I think we're ahead of the curve on that in allowing people the platforms of expression that help them use Yahoo to reach an audience of sometimes dozens, sometimes millions.
And I want to come back to this user-generated content issue, but before I do that, let me just follow up with one other thing that I thought I noticed when I talked to Terry early on in his tenure at Yahoo. Terry seemed to have more of a focus on the economics of how you actually can make money out of a product like Yahoo than a lot of the other tech guys I was talking to at the time. And I think, I may be wrong about this, but it seemed to me at that time it wasn't clear that the advertising revenue model was really going to turn out to be successful. Am I right about that? Has that turned out to really be the key to your financial success?
Absolutely. Advertising is the bulk of our revenue, and God bless Terry for having that vision and orienting our company to take advantage of that opportunity right now. But he has, again, presided over an amazing opportunity for us, and we are now a multi-billion dollar business, most of which is advertising-based. Some of that is professional services and partnerships and licensing fees and things like that, but the bulk of our revenue is advertising.
Well, that's great. Seems like it's worked out pretty well. Let's focus a little bit on the next 10 years. I think, Marilyn, you were the one who said that it's kind of hard to predict what's actually going to happen in the next 10 years. But I'd appreciate it if you give it a shot and just give us a sense for what sort of things you think we may be able to do, or even in the early part of the next 10 years, what are we going to be seeing that's going to be a little different than what we have now, or maybe what we expect?
I think they'll just be almost, I can't say they'll completely be erased, these boundaries we have now between screens, where, you know, you perform certain functions in one place and other functions in another, because some of the devices that we have out there, whether it's a PC or cell phone, do have different purposes. But I do think they begin to erode substantially, so that if you, you know, start a game on your PC, you know, the potential of finishing that game on your cell phone. The idea that you don't have to think about going to the PC for long-tail content, you can actually get that on your TV set, so that you'll see the screens that are out there actually begin to merge, and that customers, I think, what they're going to want to do is they're going to want to have the ability to move content from one place to the other, and the companies that step up to that and provide those services and also provide information along with that. So if I have a profile I want to carry from one place to the other, I don't have to re-enter information about myself in order to make that happen. So I think it's really about the maneuverability of whether I'm talking about information or whether I'm talking about entertainment, but I do see that there'll be a merging of those screens, and that will be, you know, one of the trends that we see. I also think that user-generated content, it's been fascinating. I think that in the month of September, YouTube had 35 billion streams of, you know, video being watched. I think that new access that customers have to, or users have to, telling their stories, I think we'll continue to see that proliferate. I think what will be interesting about this, though, is will those communities allow those sites to be commercialized? Mm-hmm. MySpace, the participants in MySpace, will they allow, you know, News Corp to commercialize MySpace, which, you know, is what's needed in order to get ad dollars or some other revenue stream flowing there. So I think that's a little unclear to me exactly how that will shape out and how much tolerance there will be for commercialization of user content. But I do think that with the power of, Al Gore also has a network called Current TV, which does the same thing, but now it tries to put it on a TV screen as well. So I think there'll be different avenues to have that done, but I do think that will be another big, not trend, but something that actually will grow.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Bradley?
I agree with everything Marilyn said. It's very hard to think 10 years out, but if you look at trends, I think the trend of ubiquitous computing is one that I think is an interesting one to follow. And by that, I mean all the scarce commodities right now, things like bandwidth or compute cycles or memory, they're all trending to being cheap and plentiful. And so you imagine a world where computing is integrated into the fiber of the air. I mean, the buildings themselves are nodes in a network. And computing becomes ubiquitous. I went to grad school at the MIT Media Lab, and back in the 80s when I was in school, they were just starting to do the research on wearable computing. And what that meant at the time was guys with backpacks and helmets, literally helmets, and they would strap the camera onto the helmet and ride on their unicycle around the campus, and it was all really ridiculous. I kind of averted my eyes and, you know, was embarrassed to tell people I was part of the lab with the crazies over there on the unicycles. But the truth is I carry around a computer on my person now, and I do wear this thing around, and if you try to take it away from me, we're going to have a problem, as my girlfriend knows. So a lot of those things are kind of proved true in a different form. I wouldn't wear a helmet with a camera on it, but I do enjoy having this around. I think to the point about user-generated content, I heard a great quote at Harvard Cyberposium, and it said, "We are now getting to the point where every single moment of one's life can be recorded, and that you'll have an entire archive of it." And then the pregnant pause, and then they said, "The problem is you don't get a second life with which to watch the first one." And I think the point there is that what's scarce, what is, I think there's still room to expand, but what is scarce ultimately is attention. We have a fixed amount of moments in our life, and we're all getting increasingly ADD, so I can drive beyond the phone and on my BlackBerry at the same time. I wouldn't do that, but I could do that. I've seen people do that. And so there's a certain amount of expansion just through ADD, and I think, you know, if you think we're struggling with it, the next generation can do 15 things at once. So you get a 15x expansion in people's ability to do that. And yet, at some point, that breaks down, and there's only so much attention. So when you've got 35 billion streams or billions of websites and pages, how do you best direct your attention? How do you find the things that you care about and that are meaningful to you? And so the problem of navigating through that information, I think, is the challenge and opportunity of the next 10 years. I think that the technology will empower and enable a lot of different things, and yet here we are with finite lifespan and finite attention, and we as an industry are going to have to get better and better at allowing people to make choices about how they want to spend their time online and off.
Well, in some sense, you're going to perhaps have to make some of those choices for them. You know, one of the things I wanted to ask about the user-generated content phenomenon is that, you can generate a lot of content, but you can't necessarily get anybody to watch it, and especially, you know, the lower the quality, probably the harder it is to get people to watch it. And it occurs to me that maybe we're at the stage with user-generated content that you were with the unicycle and the helmet, where, we've got a lot of stuff out there, but it's still a little unclear how this is ever going to be resolved into something that people pay attention to. Any thoughts that either of you have on that subject?
Well, I have a thought. One of the advantages of the long tail is that it's not necessarily about driving a big audience. So, a picture of a baby may not be generally interesting except to the baby's, you know, grandmother. It's very interesting to an audience of, you know, a dozen people. And so part of what's empowered here is the ability to publish, but it isn't about attracting a mass audience in all cases. Sometimes it's about reaching the dozen people that care about the content that you put out there, whether it's friends and family or a small group of fly fishermen who want to see how to build a lure, those kinds of things. So that kind of ability to hit the small audience in the world that cares passionately about what you have to share is also part of the vision.
Mm-hmm. I would also say that, you know, when we think about, I'm going to use a TV example because I think that it's been presumed that the TV is going to be left out of the long tail of space, and I actually don't think that's the right assumption. But I think you've got to bring tools to the TV, and you have to put them in the hands of a consumer that's using a remote control, which has limited functionality, in order to get access. So you can't just show up with a dump truck of content. You actually have to give customers, for example, and a new version of our what we call our interactive media guide that we're putting out on Fios TV, we're having a search engine that actually borrows very much from the kind of technologies that are both used with a cell phone in terms of triple tap as one of the options to search, and it uses predictive search capabilities to sort of guess what might be the subject matter area and give customers options around that. So if they're looking for a movie with a certain actor or actress in it, you can actually search based on that, and you can search across what ultimately will be, you know, PCs that are tied into the network, but today, you know, DVD, scheduled programming, as well as what might be on your DVR. And those kinds of tools will help customers get at mm-hmm. what might not be completely, it's not going to be blockbuster content, but things that will be useful to them. And they could actually even be in the area of education and how to. We are finding that by creating the support for DVD development, we can actually bring a lot of DVD-based content to the TV set as well. But again, you've got to provide the tools to help customers find them, or else it they just gets buried in the heat.
I think that, yeah, that's a very good point. Of course, I'm the one who brought it up, so no wonder I think so. we're at the point now where I'd love to entertain some questions, and I'll have some questions too. We can just kind of mix them back and forth. But please let me know if you do have questions, and we'll get right to you. Yes, sir.
I'm Gary Arlen from Arlen Communications. You talked about ADD. More importantly, this issue of the attention economy, where attention spans are very short. Yahoo Video certainly caters to a lot of that, as opposed to Terry Semel's view of the motion pictures online. Where do you see this going, and especially how does it start to compete to affect bandwidth capabilities, both wired and especially wireless, which has some other cost associated with it, as people want lots and lots of short bits of bites of video?
Yeah, one of the interesting corollaries to the fact that you can target to a micro audience is a lot of the peer-to-peer technologies, and people have, you know, touted peer-to-peer as some of the solution for this, don't work. You know, they work well if we're all getting, you know, the matrix and your neighbors have a stored copy on their server and you can leverage that grid network to bring it over. But if you're talking about an audience of a dozen people, it's basically back to point to point. And so you don't have the efficiencies in distribution that you get from a broadcast model where lots of people are digesting the same content. I think that partly the short form video that we're enjoying now on sites like Yahoo Video and YouTube is an artifact of the technology. Short form was all we could manage, and partly it's an artifact of ADD and people's attention. And in fact, ADD is an interesting topic. I named my group at Yahoo. I'm the VP of ADD, the Advanced Development Division. And, you know, that was not accidental. I don't know if it slid by or they caught on later, but I got away with it. But I certainly agree that our attention spans, and again, talking about the next generation, we work a lot with young people and study young people and listen to young people, and I think, you know, you're right, the attention spans are getting shorter, and we need to build products and facilities that respond to that. In terms of the bandwidth, I want to toss that question to Marilyn because she's dealing more directly with that. I think she mentioned before that, you know, wise investment to make ahead of demand. And my inclination, at least for the foreseeable future, is that as much bandwidth as we put out there, as you intimated, people will find ways to consume that.
Yeah. In terms of the short burst data, it's actually easier to manage that on a data network than it is the long form. So for us, it's actually not that. It's really more sustaining a sort of 90-minute video when people want to download that to their PCs or watch it. Well, with wireless, there's some new technologies. We just, of course, announced that we're actually putting TV shows on a cell phone. And so that's enabled with a Qualcomm technology called MediaFlow. And so, again, they're not actually doing mobisodes in that case. They're taking, you know, traditional TV shows, which could be 30 minutes or more, and putting them on the cell phone. So that comes with advances. You have to manage that spectrum, obviously, when you put those products out and there's wide acceptance. But it's really, I think, back to the, I think the other, the positive side of ADD, if there is one, is that, you know, the generation that's out there now can multitask, and they are doing many more things at one time. And so when we think of product development, when I was first, we really weren't factoring that in. And I think now you've got to sort of factor in the fact that people are not going to be necessarily happy just with big blockbuster content. They're not just going to be happy with doing one thing at a time, that they do overlay, whether it's so let me give you a more traditional example. What customers are doing now with watching a football game. So they have their fantasy team going, and they have all the stats going on that. It could be now on their PC, but now there's programs that we're going to be overlaying that onto the TV experience so they can watch their own team as they're watching whatever is going on that Sunday afternoon. And then they also have, you know, the ability to talk with their friends and chat back and forth. And so those kinds of things are actually expanding the entertainment experience. So if there's a positive side to ADD here, I think it's about serving the multitask consumer who really does want to do more than one thing at a time.
Interesting. Beth? Oh, I have several of them. Yes, sir.
Yeah, you mentioned that Yahoo is a media company, and you were talking about Verizon's kind of entertainment offers. And one thing that's distinctive about the U.S. media scene is that there were kind of local newspapers, local radio, and local television, and then sort of national media grew up out of those local media, which is different than more of the state-oriented. So I'm wondering how that affects your business planning, this sort of history of localism in the U.S., and how that affects sort of products you might be developing, and how kind of is localism relevant to your business plans, or is it kind of, are you a national media service?
I think we're, you know, both a global media company and a citizen micro media company. It kind of, I think what's changing is that it used to be kind of phase shifts. There was kind of, you know, national media shifting to regional media, shifting to state or local media. And that is really changing now in that there's more of a continuum. And so we certainly deal with, you know, traditional media companies. Yahoo News is powered by Reuters and Dow Jones and folks like that. But you also have on Yahoo News bloggers and people with individual voices. So it's everything from, a political blogger to someone who has a rant. You know, everything is fair game in this new information economy. And so Yahoo isn't necessarily biasing things one way or another. We see opportunity across that spectrum. Citizen journalism, you know, you can call it this blogging phenomenon, is really just people sharing opinion and sharing their aspect. And some of this stuff is actually surprising. For instance, with the London bombings that happened over a year ago, well before the news wires had photos of those events available for redistribution, we were getting uploads on our Flickr photo site, just man-in-the-street photos, people that were taking their camera phones and uploading that content and making it available for others. They weren't journalists, they weren't reporters in that sense, but they were on the scene, connected to other people, and were able to kind of contribute that into the commons, into the pool, even though they didn't have a press badge on them. So I think what we're seeing is the distinction blurring, and again, the onus is on us to seize opportunity there and make it navigable and reputable and trustable. So there's a big challenge ahead of us when you have a world where anyone can contribute anything to an audience of billions. How can we help people find content that they trust from people that they care about or respect or feel are reputable? And that's the challenge ahead for our company.
If I could just add one more thing on that. As a matter of fact, in this market, next couple of months, we're going to be launching our first, original content, if you will. It's called Fios One. It'll be our local channel, and it's really to address what you're talking about, that you have to bring the national programming, the mass CTV, but you also have to respect the customers are very much interested in the local affairs. And that includes, what's going on from a community standpoint, but also the high school football team and, whatever colleges are in the area. Mm-hmm. So, we're not doing very much original programming because there's so much good stuff out there, but we will be developing local channels so that we can address the demand that's out there and actually to get hyper-local. As a matter of fact, we're going to be giving cameras to local citizen VJs to go out there and create stories that will be part of the lineup.
Interesting. You had a question, I think, sir? Yeah.
Specific market, a neighborhood that I care about, what's going on in my neighborhood or some neighborhood that I care about, particularly for unstructured data. I mean, we do it pretty well for structured, but for unstructured data.
So I am a huge fan of location-based services. One of the great things about wearable computers like this is that they know where I am, and my BlackBerry doesn't have GPS. Eventually, the devices will, but it does know I'm near Singular Transponder 49J, which is in Washington, D.C., so we can already get rough locality and neighborhood, and it's hugely beneficial in terms of providing additional context. My phone knows who I am, it knows where I am, it knows what time it is, it knows the behavior across many millions of people of other people here, and all of those things can be leveraged to provide a better and better experience. And when typing is kind of hard on my thumbs like this, it's much easier to type in weather and have the device provide the rest of the context. Oh, you mean weather in Washington, D.C. right now, and fill in the blanks that way. So I think there's huge opportunity in local. We're investing heavily. One of the things that Yahoo Local does, which is not widely known, but I think going to become increasingly important, is have a listing, a stub listing in some cases, for every local business in the country. So the dry cleaners on the corner to the auto parts store already has a page on Yahoo where people can come and leave reviews and establish eventually communities around the local coffee shop. And virtually every business entity can become a hub of interaction and community. And so pivoting around these kinds of local interest points, whether they're a local dog park or a local auto parts store, I think is a big part of what you'll see from Yahoo in the coming months. And this is already happening on things like Yahoo Groups. We have millions of groups in Yahoo Groups, and it turns out that a very large fraction of those are things like community or neighborhood associations. So people are already using our tools to connect with each other, to find each other, and establish this kind of virtual neighborhood presence in cyberspace.
Well, I mean, I think you've told the wireless story for me, so absolutely. I think that GPS-based services, location-based services are more and more. We've rolled out our Navigator service, which, if you don't have GPS in your car, you can use our Navigator service to get directions, and it's going to respond to where you're at. And so those things are very, very powerful, and I think we've only really begun to see the very beginning of the potential and how they can link to other services, but it's very powerful technology. I agree.
Mm-hmm. Yes, ma'am.
How much... consumer privacy and safety a part of the discussion going forward with GPS? You know, we all know that CTIA has been working hard on filtering content and, you know, developing labels and ratings and stuff, and it's all very Web 1.0 because it's all sort of media being pushed at the consumer, but how much are you thinking about protecting consumers from themselves and each other?
It's, for Yahoo, it's huge. The covenant that we have with our consumers is something that we've worked hard to earn over a decade, and once broken, it's very, very difficult to ever restore. So there are huge policy and privacy advocates within the company that are watching very closely to make sure we never take a step beyond a boundary that we and the consumers themselves are comfortable with. And I almost wanted to mention this when I was answering the question. You know, it's fraught with complications around issues of privacy. I think the most important thing in the early going here is to be extremely explicit in terms of disclosing to the user and expectation setting and terms of service exactly what kind of data we might collect, what happens to that data downstream, how long it is stored, giving people gigantic buttons that say opt out of this for either a, you know, ephemeral period or permanently, and kind of ceding control to the user, never overstepping our bounds and making assumptions about what we think is fair use of that information, but making sure they're clear and their choice is explicit to them.
I mean, we've got decades of a legacy of having to protect our customers' information. As a matter of fact, when our sales reps talk to customers on the phone, they have to ask for permission to talk, to use their records to talk about their services. I mean, that's just how much a part of our culture it is. So we approach all of these things very, very carefully. It is about disclosure. In many cases, if you ever get down to a customer level, which you don't always need to, lots of times it's about aggregating behaviors and using an aggregation of a behavior to inform. But if you ever get down to a consumer's personal behavior, it needs to be on an opt-in basis. You know, the consumer needs to have said that's okay. And so I think we just try to take those tenets to bear every time we think about this. But it is, again, we have a strong group of policy advocates and privacy advocates in the company that we work with very closely to make sure that we don't violate our very tenets.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you a question. We talked about some of the great things we've done, some of the great things we may be able to do in the future. What are a couple obstacles that are out there that might make it hard for us to achieve what we're trying to achieve? I know you guys are probably more in the optimistic category, but can you think of a couple things that would prevent us from reaching what we otherwise might be able to reach?
Well, I think, again, we touched on this before, but there's almost an embarrassment of riches. And I give a presentation, the first five slides of which are really very uplifting and empowering, and it's about, you know, taking control away from the man and handing it back to the people, and it's you know, a great story. And then, you know, the punchline to that kind of preamble is I say, and here's what we get, and then there's a video of a chimp doing karate with a guy, and it's hilarious. You know, everyone always laughs when they see this. But there's also something very sad about that kind of, you know, you kind of empower people and you're talking about this personal expression, and the best we can come up with as a culture is kind of, you know, stupid human tricks and frat boy pratfalls, and, you know, it's rather sad. So I think the good news is that that's not all of the content that's out there, and I think it's very early going. It's for us as a society and a culture, and we're learning together what's possible, and we're testing the limits and boundaries of what's possible. I think the real challenge, again, is to take, you know, a world where we're going to have more content than you can possibly manage, and it would be easy to drown in that content and make sense of it and do it in a way that is engaging and not too limiting. I mean, one thing that is a challenge, one of the wonderful things that I love about the web is serendipity, that I will bump into things and people and ideas that I never would in the normal course of events. And what you don't want to do in terms of predictive text or any kinds of suggestions, if you get into a world where people who like that also like this, where is there space for a dissenting opinion? Where is there balance in that kind of world of the future? So I don't want to lose the serendipity, and yet I don't want to just, you know, have a dial with 40 billion places on it. So there's somewhere in between, and I think that is the big challenge for the industry, is to take advantage of this phenomenon and not you know, drown in the information overload.
You know, I agree. I think that there is so much more upside in terms of how these applications can improve healthcare, can improve the education system, and I think we've just only scratched the surfaces. When you think about the cost and in terms of our healthcare pie, the cost that is consumed by information management, and the fact that we really haven't broken the code on getting a good handle on that, and yet we have all these technologies that could help, whether it's a common profile for a family and their health, their background. So I think that there's some real areas that we need to put more resources around figuring out. I think education, we've only really getting scratch the surface on that. I think one of the things I do worry about, and I know this will, I don't know how Bradley's going to react to this, but I do worry about the assumption that all the stuff that's out there will be paid by advertising. I wonder if there's enough advertising out there to pay for everything that people assume will be paid for by advertising.
I would like to comment on that. It is not our intention that everything will be paid by advertising, and I'm sure...
Not yours, but I think there's...
No. I mean, you know, I wouldn't, for instance, want to hear a 30-second jingle before I could make a call. You know, even if the call were free, Verizon has such great rates, I'd rather pay. So it's not our intention, and I think a good example for that is really around monetizing some of this personal information and personal data. You saw a big outcry and backlash when companies got too aggressive in terms of monetizing your personal email. So if you're reading an email about a death in the family, you don't necessarily want to see the ad for the mortuary over there, contextually relevant, but perhaps insensitive to the content that you're reading. So the good news for a company like Yahoo that is a portfolio is we have a very wide array of products. Some of those will be aggressively monetized, and I think the prototypical example is search. When I lean into a search box and I type in, you know, digital camera price, that's a pretty good indication that you're in the market, and if we can help connect you to a vendor that will get you the best, cheapest digital camera, we haven't imposed upon you or overstepped our boundary. We've actually provided a service, and that's the holy grail. That's what we're after is advertising not as imposition, but advertising as content itself. It's relevant to my intention in the moment, and you can't always achieve that holy grail in every experience, but that's what we're trending toward, is a world where advertising is less intrusive, more relevant, more meaningful, more okay with the people that are receiving it, and they'll have more and more knobs to kind of tune that advertising experience to become more relevant to them.
Anybody out there have a question? Yes.
On paper, but 10 times as many people see us online. And last year, of the 5 most downloaded articles, 4 of them were videos. Quality video is possible, but here's my question. Particularly when the goal is science, health, education by a nonprofit, how do you pay for it? Advertising, in our example, wasn't the answer. And what it's easy to get lousy videos. Getting really good videos from experts is kind of like squaring the circle. They don't. It takes a lot of resources.
Well, I think, you know, I'm just going to point to what we've done. We have a doctor here that I actually, he was quoted, I think, in some of the articles, but he actually is receiving reports, x-rays, pictures at his home so he can diagnose, and he's doing it on a fiber network. So what it takes is something like that. I think the good news about our fiber network is that you can get that service at 15x2 service for $35 to $40 a month, which is a mass market rate for broadband. So I think that the good news is that as we roll out these services and more people consume them, the scale of that allows us to keep the prices lower. So it isn't just a large business or a hospital that can download that article, but actually a doctor at his home who actually needs it and can use it for reports. So unfortunately, I think it's an infrastructure answer in part, affordable infrastructure that allows somebody to have access to exactly what you're talking about in a way that is that's dependable, right? And it doesn't, you know, you're not waiting for long buffering and you're not getting choppy video that's going to make it really unusable for what you're trying to do.
I don't have an answer to your question specifically, but I will say that some of the most exciting video that I've seen on the net, things that aren't chimps doing karate, is the MIT OpenCourseWare project, where I can see lectures from MIT professors open and available to anyone in the world. They don't confer degrees with this, but you can actually sit in there and get some fantastic quality content. MIT is probably in a position where they don't have to worry too much about the bandwidth or the funding and where it comes from. And I'm not sure every nonprofit entity enjoys that luxury, but I think there's huge opportunity for use of media in education. And I think we have to figure out, and I think it will be different for different channels, but we have to figure out collectively as a society how we're going to empower that to happen. And I agree that that's an example where I don't know that advertising would be appropriate at all when you've got a scientific journal that wants to be really for the public, into the public commons, and not, you don't want to see a Lipitor ad before, before the video.
Well, I'm afraid we're just about out of time. In fact, I think we are out of time. So if you would join me in thanking Marilyn and Bradley, I appreciate your time.